From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Biden is speaking in Tulsa, Oklahoma today to memorialize those who died in a race massacre there 100 years ago. On this day in 1921, a white mob continued its attack on black residents in Tulsa's Greenwood District. So prosperous at the time, it was known as Black Wall Street. The mob burned down homes and businesses and killed as many as 300 people. President Biden will use today's visit to unveil sweeping new policies to address the racial wealth gap. NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe joins us now. Aisha, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And why don't we start with the symbolism of the president's visit to Tulsa today? Because for so many years, this massacre was just pretty much ignored. And now a president is marking the anniversary. How meaningful is that?
It is meaningful because it was ignored. And then it was also for a long time called a riot, made as if it was, the black people, a race riot in the town, when what it was a massacre. It was an attack by a white mob on this prosperous black town. And so after all of these years, 100 years, to finally have the federal government at least, marking this moment and saying this happened and acknowledging that, it is meaningful and it is significant, especially when white people were indicted for this. There were no repercussions for those who carried this out.
Well, President Biden is meeting with people from the community. What do they want from the president or the federal government?
I think what they asked for, you had survivors testify before Congress recently, and what they were asking for is justice overall. They do want reparations. That would come from the state and the local government because it is argued that actually the state or town deputized some of these white individuals who went into the town and attacked, and so that this was state violence that they should get reparations for what happened. And so I think by having the federal government there, there's a desire for acknowledgement, but also for pressure, for something to be done in a meaningful way to address the harm that happened.
I think it's important to point out that this massacre, like many other horrible acts of violence in other cities in our history, wiped out black wealth and prosperity at the time, which, continues its legacy today and contributes to the wealth gap that we see today. So what is the president trying to do to address it?
So what President Biden is going to announce actions today that would try to address racial discrimination in the housing market. Obviously, housing is the way people in the U.S. are able to pass along their wealth, the way most people are able to pass along their wealth. So addressing disparities there and also trying to get more money to small disadvantaged businesses through government contracting.
Tell me more about those disadvantaged businesses. How would that work?
So basically what the government is going to do is try to use federal contracting. There's so much money in that, and try to raise the amount of money that goes to small disadvantaged businesses. And that would also, put a priority on my minority-owned businesses. And so to raise that by 50%, government investment in that by 50%. And what they say is that would translate to more an additional $100 billion over 5 years if they are able to meet that target.
And what do we know about the issue of student debt forgiveness? It looks like the NAACP thinks that the president's proposed plan hasn't gone far enough.
Yes, that is a complaint from NAACP National President Derek Johnson. He says that if the administration really wants to address the racial wealth gap, that they should deal with the student loan debt crisis because that falls disproportionately on black Americans. And so they are saying that they need to address that. That is not called for in the current plan that is going to be unrolled today. But that is a complaint that the NAACP is making, that there should be something to deal with student loan debt.
And just briefly, Aisha, where does the president plan to get this money?
Well, so, right, the money for the contracting would be money that's already available. And then when they when they're dealing with the housing discrimination, that would be, you know, in agencies looking at how they can do enforcement actions to stop discrimination. The rest of the money for investment in communities would be from the American Jobs Plan. So that would be something that would have to be passed by Congress.
I see. NPR White House correspondent Ayesha Roscoe, thank you very much for your reporting.
Thank you.
Well, let's check in with Julian Zelizer now. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And Julian, this visit by President Biden to Tulsa, we heard Ayesha talk about how significant this is for a sitting president to acknowledge the racist atrocities of the past and talk specifically about addressing the harm. Have we ever seen something like this before?
Well, we've seen commissions that deal with some of these issues, like the Kerner Commission in 1968. But here you have the President of the United States putting himself at the forefront of talking about this massacre, acknowledging what it was, and starting a conversation about public policy. So I think it's an important historical moment.
You know, I also want to talk with you about another maybe first in recent memory. Republicans last week blocked the plan to form an independent commission to investigate the January 6th attack on the Capitol. They used a filibuster, as we know, to stop the commission in the Senate, even though Democrats control the chamber. Before we talk about the historical implications of not having this commission, we've long been having discussions about the mechanisms of the filibuster itself. What did you think about the filibuster as a tactic in this case?
Well, it shows once again that the filibuster is a tactic of obstruction, not deliberation. This is another instance where the filibuster has prevented Washington from governing and dealing with the issues of the day. This was low-hanging fruit, to investigate a violent attack on Congress and the vice president, but instead it was filibustered away.
You think it's time to get rid of it?
I think the arguments for eliminating the filibuster are much stronger than those supporting it, at a minimum, to seriously reform it so it's harder to use. This just doesn't have a good history in American politics, and it's repeatedly something that has prevented politicians from tackling issues.
You know, we spoke with you early on when this idea of a commission was proposed, and you said it was a good idea because this was one of the most serious domestic attacks on the government in our history. Well, now we won't get answers to many of the questions we still have about what happened. How damaging do you think that is for our democracy moving forward?
It's very damaging. We don't have a bipartisan investigation of what happened and some kind of report. And so that just opens the door for the partisan characterizations of what happened. It allows conspiracy theories to be even stronger and mischaracterizations. And for Republicans, it kind of reveals that this is not a priority for them, and this is not something they consider serious. So it says a lot about where the party is in 2021.
Is there any way to get around what happened in the Senate? Couldn't the House, which really is controlled by Democrats at this time, use committee hearings to investigate what happened?
Of course, they can have hearings, and this can be done through the congressional process. They might do that, but instantly it will be characterized as an explicit partisan investigation rather than a bipartisan commission. And we saw how that worked out with impeachment, and I think the movie will be exactly the same. And so it will undermine some of the weight that a big commission report could carry.
You mentioned the Kerner Commission from the 1960s in relation to the Tulsa massacre and what's happening there. But remind us of the value of past commissions like this. I'm thinking, first of all, the 9/11 Commission. How did it help us understand that event?
It was an imperfect commission. The commission had trouble getting a lot of information from the administration. There were accusations that they left certain issues out to protect leaders. But it still produced a really substantive, lengthy, bipartisan report about all the intelligence failures that allowed 9/11 to happen. And that became a basis for reforms that actually moved through the legislative branch. So even though it's flawed, I think that's a good example of why these commissions can be extraordinarily important.
you use the word bipartisanship. I mean, that's one thing that might just be impossible these days.
It might be. I mean, it was already hard there. The commission, the 9/11 commission, had to work against partisanship, and it was tough, but it still was able to produce a report. I'm not sure that's possible today. I think the Republicans revealed where they are right now, and they're pretty determined not to allow this to be an issue, especially going into the midterm election.
Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. As always, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Two decades ago, would you have guessed there would be one place where you could buy just about anything your heart desires with one click of a button, from clothes to groceries and everything in between? Well, today we know that space is Amazon, and it's worth more than $1 trillion. Its CEO, Jeff Bezos, has a personal fortune greater than the GDP of many countries. Well, a new book details Amazon's lightning speed rise over the last few years and how the company has upended industries in every corner of the economy. Brad Stone is senior executive editor of technology at Bloomberg News and author of the new book, Amazon Unbound, Jeff Bezos and the Invention of a Global Empire. Welcome.
Hi, Tanya. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Well, this is not your first book about Amazon. In fact, you write that when you published The Everything Store way back in 2013, you thought you had actually written the comprehensive book on Amazon's rise. But of course, that was before so many of the technologies we use now from Amazon came to be. Are you surprised by just how huge it has grown since you wrote your first book?
Oh, absolutely. I think when I published the first book, the market capitalization of Amazon was about $80 billion. It is today close to $1.7 trillion. I mean, that kind of growth is unheard of. You know, the sprawl into almost every industry imaginable, the growth of its cloud computing business, its expansion into other countries like India, new products like Alexa, and then this sort of dawning sense, and I think this is probably the big thing that changed, that this was not just an innovative story of entrepreneurship and internet magic, but a kind of story about monopoly and a company that's gotten so big that people are really starting to worry about it.
This book is also about the company, but also Jeff Bezos, the CEO, and his very particular management style. You write he takes on a very hands-on approach to things like product management, like the development of Amazon Web Services, for instance. Bezos would actually ask executives in other parts of the company, what are you doing for AWS? And he did the same thing later with Echo. Just how involved is he in the product management in the day-to-day and why?
Right. It actually varies. What I found in researching this book is he has taken a very active role in the creation of new businesses and products, and then the sponsorship. So early on, he had the idea for Alexa. He emailed executives with this idea of creating a $20 computer whose brains are in the cloud, completely controllable by your voice. And then he draws the first whiteboard drawing of an Echo device. And then he meets with that team sometimes multiple times a week, picks the name Alexa. And so that's sort of one operating style. And then on the other end, he actually has taken a very hands-off approach and I think has become increasingly distant from the bigger parts of Amazon, and that's AWS and the retail business. And now we see that, you know, on July 5th, he's going to really step back formally and no longer be CEO. But I think he'll continue to, you know, he says he'll continue to do what he's been doing these past few years, which is really micromanage the newer things that he can get excited about.
I want to ask you about that micromanagement, because your book really lays out well how demanding of a CEO he is. He has this habit of forwarding emails from customers to other executives and adding a single question mark, which meant he expected an answer to that question within 24 hours. You also write that Bezos would forward those question mark emails in the middle of the night. What else did you learn about Bezos's management style?
Well, it's really evolved over the years. So the question mark emails have remained somewhat consistent, and occasionally they will be accompanied by a little note like WTF question mark. And when you get one of those, you know, I think that it's real
Bezos?
Panic inducing.
I'm sure.
But if you can only imagine. But early on, he really had a brusque style, and he could be incredibly demeaning towards employees. And in Amazon Unbound, I actually flash back to meetings where he would find a mathematical error in a memo and rip up the document and kind of throw it across the table and walk out. And I think over the years, he sort of realized that with his, you know, the increase of his stature, the growth of the company, that he could no longer do that. And so he sort of bottled that up. But he really does wield this potent mixture of inspiration and intimidation.
Brett, I want to talk to you more about Bezos' ambitions for Amazon, because as we know, it goes well beyond retail. Amazon is now a cloud computing giant, a physical retailer, a major player in Hollywood. And then there's Bezos' personal acquisitions of the Washington Post and this space exploration company, Blue Origin. What exactly does Bezos get out of all of these different companies? Why isn't he content with dominating one sector of the economy like retail?
I mean, they're different, right? He bought the Washington Post opportunistically because it was available, because he thought he could make a difference with a declining media institution, and he certainly has. Blue Origin, a space company, is a childhood passion, although, you know, they have yet to really show significant results. And with Amazon, I think the underlying value there is change and transformation. He realized early on, when Amazon was just a plain old bookseller, if people remember that, that, you know, on the internet, companies need to evolve and constantly need to reinvent themselves. You know, transformation and the willingness to reinvent is what underlies a lot of these moves.
Amazon is, of course, embroiled in multiple antitrust investigations. But you write that to make a credible case for breaking up Amazon, the trustbusters will have to answer questions the company goes to remarkable lengths to obscure. Is Amazon actually vulnerable to being broken up or meaningfully penalized for anti-competitive business practices? Or is it, right, as you suggest, almost invincible?
I have a difficult time seeing how Amazon is ever broken up. I mean, you go back to the 1990s where Microsoft was targeted by the Department of Justice, a multi-year investigation, and that case was strong. Microsoft had more than a 95% share of the operating system market for desktops. It was a monopoly, and it wasn't broken up. And then you look at Amazon today, and it competes in these very large markets like retail, where it probably still has a single-digit percentage of the market, even in North America, or enterprise computing, where the biggest competitor is Microsoft, which is actually a larger company by market cap. And it's very difficult to make the case that, you know, Amazon is a monopoly. Now, I do think there will be productive lines of inquiry and antitrust investigations into Amazon. And in fact, last May, the Attorney General of Washington, D.C. filed a case against Amazon saying that its price parity provisions were anti-competitive. And that's basically Amazon's rule that sellers can't sell for a lower price on their own website and on competing services. And Amazon can make the argument that Walmart does something like that and Target does something like that. But I think as Amazon gets ever larger, provisions like that, it's going to have to back away from. So I don't think Amazon will be broken up. I think that's a difficult case to make. I think that the trust busters are quite distracted with all the companies they have to investigate now. But I do think Amazon's going to get a lot of attention and might have to change the way it conducts business.
Hmm. Amazon is coming out of this pandemic stronger than ever, thanks to record sales while everyone was quarantined. You write Amazon was unique among companies of its size because it actually got in front of questions like releasing numbers of how many frontline employees tested positive for COVID, and that it spent billions on COVID protections, but that during the pandemic, it also fired several workers who mounted prominent campaigns, you know, agitating and pushing for stronger safety protocols. Where does Amazon stand now as the U.S. seems like it's emerging from the worst of this pandemic?
I would agree that Amazon, the business, came out of COVID very healthy. Almost perversely, the company that had all the advantages going into the pandemic had even more during it, as stores closed and competitors were crippled. So in that respect, the business got almost an injection of steroids. But from a public image perspective, they did actually kind of get hammered. And in terms of the safety precautions and advertising some of their moves, a lot of it was in response to criticism. I don't know that they got ahead of it. And the way in which they acted to dismiss whistleblowers. I just think it left a lot of people inside and outside the company with a little bit of distaste. So there are more questions than ever about the character of this company.
With that, though, you know, the thing about Amazon is it's constantly elevating our expectations. And I'm just wondering from you how you view Amazon's role in really shaping culture and society. How has Amazon changed really our ways and modes of being and our expectations, not just in consumerism, but also in our day-to-day lives, how we work, what we expect out of goods and services? It's really revolutionized society.
It really has. And I write in the book that I don't think there's a company or a person who's done more to change our economic reality. It's also changed the fabric of our communities. And I look outside my door right now and I see Amazon vans crawling up and down my neighborhood, dropping off products, and Amazon mm-hmm. trucks on the highway, you know, and then also, frankly, stores on Main Street that are empty, probably because of the pandemic. But certainly Amazon has had an impact and it has, you know, staged an assault on independent bookstores. And so we've lost something as well. And it's really hard. And I've tried to grapple with this in the book to kind of tally, you know, has this been good for society? Has it not? And in the end, we need to understand this company and kind of vote with our dollars if we want to see, you know, the stores and the culture and the commerce survive in our communities.
That's Brad Stone, senior executive editor for technology at Bloomberg News and author of the new book, Amazon Unbound, Jeff Bezos and the Invention of a Global Empire. Brad, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Tanya.
An officer pins a 16-year-old to the ground and punches out his teeth. But are there any consequences for the cop? For the first time, we take you inside the secret investigations that show how police protections in California shield officers from accountability. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
There's a potentially record-breaking heat wave baking the western United States right now. It's only June 1st, and temperatures are running 15 to 20 degrees above normal in California's Central Valley. Fresno could hit 106 degrees today. That is hotter than the forecast for the desert here in Phoenix. The other weather story of note today is that the Atlantic hurricane season is now officially underway. Jeff Huffman is director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, welcome back.
Hello, Peter.
And we spoke many times during the 2020 season. It was historically active, 30 named storms. What does 2021 look like?
Well, the forecast is for likely an above average season. In fact, all reputable forecast agencies are predicting that. Even NOAA is saying that there's a 70% confidence level in the forecast for the numbers that are well above the normals. And even those normals, Peter, have been shifted or changed because we're now in a new decade and they update those 30-year running averages every 10 years. So The confidence is quite high that some of the same factors that led to the historic season last year are still in place this year, although there are indications that it will not be as active as last year, thankfully. But nonetheless, another active year in the Atlantic Basin is likely on tap.
What do we see in the Atlantic right now? Any storms brewing?
Nothing brewing right now. We've already had our first named storm of the season. That was Anna about 2 weeks ago. But thankfully, conditions are relatively quiet. We are seeing an uptick in moisture in the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico. The rainy season, of course, in the southeast is beginning in the next week or two. So we'll be watching for, of course, tropical storms this time of year. Just a reminder that even though the season begins today, most of the hurricanes and nearly all of the major hurricanes occur in August, September, and October. So we still can see activity, obviously, this early in the season, but it's a six-month season. So just because it begins today, we need to stay prepared for the next 6 months.
Right. There was a change this year. Forecasters are no longer going to be using the Greek alphabet to name storms as they did last year when they exhausted the traditional alphabet. There were so many storms. So why is that? Why no more Greek alphabet?
Well, I think it was because the idea did not give consideration to a Greek alphabet storm needing to be retired. And we had that occur last year. So once one of those letters is taken away from the Greek alphet, it kind of left them with a decision to make. And I think they've made a change to now include other names like we have during the season. But this is going to be like an auxiliary list that's pulled from only as needed if we exhaust the regular storm names of the year.
At the start of this six-month storm season, what's your message for people as they get ready for, you know, what might be ahead?
Well, just remember, the accuracy of the seasonal forecast is slightly higher than 50%. I did a study on this a few years ago, and we've seen numerous seasons where there's been an example of the number of storms that form in the Atlantic does not always correlate to how many may make landfall in any particular location. For example, last year, a historic season, and we know the Gulf Coast, especially Louisiana, was hit hard with five storms. Other large population areas of our country were relatively unharmed. So just remember that every year we prepare the same, and we are in a period of more active hurricanes than normal, even though those normals may be changing. And we've also seen several more intense hurricanes. So we still have time to prepare, and I encourage anyone who's in a hurricane-prone area to spend the next week or two doing what you can to prepare for the season ahead.
Season runs from June 1st to November 30th, so I'm sure we're going to be speaking again, but let's hope not too often. Jeff Huffman,
I would agree.
Director and Chief Meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, thank you. What a difference a year makes. The TSA screened almost 9 million people at U.S. airports over the holiday weekend, and Friday set a record for the single biggest travel day since March 2020. And here's another record. Reports of unruly passenger behavior so far this year are 20 times higher than a typical 12-month period. Here and now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan joins us now. And Seth, let's start with the crowds at the airports over the weekend. How did the airports do?
They were back up to something like three quarters or more in some cases of a typical Memorial Day holiday travel period. So up from nearly nothing last year. You think about what we were going through in May to not quite what it was back in 2019, but a lot closer to 2019 than to 2020. People feeling good, feeling vaccinated, of course. You could pretty much draw a straight line between that and what we're seeing now. You go back just five or 6 months and travel was still closer to zero than closer to the old levels.
So I haven't been on a plane since February of 2020. So what is it like to fly these days and how much have ticket prices gone up?
Well, taking the second part first, ticket prices are going up a bit unevenly, and that's kind of like so much else, it's been unpredictable during the pandemic, right? There are some places where you'll still get a rather good deal and others where you'd be surprised at how much you'll pay. And almost wherever you go, by the way, rental car rates are the real source of sticker shock.
Right.
Hertz went bankrupt, sold off all kinds of cars, and other companies got rid of a lot of cars. And so whereas airlines have somewhat been able to meet the demand, it's really expensive to rent a car when you get where you're going. Onboard flights are full. They are about as full as they ever were. Airlines are flying a little less than they used to. Passenger loads are a little less than they used to, but you add it all up and you can get on a plane that's nearly full right now with all airlines at this point basically selling all their seats, no longer blocking those middle seats as some were at some point. And you still have to wear a mask when you're on board a plane, different now from some other parts of society.
Right. And with all those passengers on airplanes, there's a lot of bad behavior. Flight attendant union leader Sarah Nelson told CNBC last week that the situation has never been like this. Let's listen.
It's complete nuts, and it's a constant combative attitude. And this is just something we've never seen before in aviation to this level.
And Seth, since January 1st, the FAA has recorded 2,500 incidents of air rage, and many of those are because passengers are refusing to wear those masks on the planes. Just how bad is it?
Yeah, and if anything, Peter, it seems to be more confusing now for some people than it was because – you know, they see headlines about the CDC saying you can take off your mask in a lot of places. That's true, of course, in a lot of parts of society, but not in an airport or on an airplane. Understandable because we're just packed so closely when we're on an airplane and children, of course, young children still not vaccinated. But anecdotally, I can tell you, speaking to people at airports and at airlines, that seems to be a source of it, right? People, oh, I thought I could take off my mask. No, you can't. Not yet. And so, yeah, you get that. Also, the fact, Peter, that when we talk about travel mostly recovering but not recovering back to previous levels, leisure travel has nearly fully recovered. It's business travel that's still way down. And if you think about it, business travelers are the people who just kind of travel all the time, know the rules. Leisure travelers, right, in a lot of cases, especially as you mentioned yourself, haven't been on a plane in a long time. They're the ones who don't always know what to expect. And all of this is a bigger surprise as people fly again for the first time since way back more than a year ago in many cases.
Well, to try to get a control on some of these problems, both American and Southwest have decided that they're not going to serve alcohol on their flights anymore. How long do you think that will last?
We'll see. Southwest actually was getting ready to start serving alcohol again and pulled back on that after one widely publicized recent incident aboard a Southwest flight. So, yeah, not something I think will last forever. You know, I think in the end, these airlines are going to conclude that, you know what, most people know how to behave, and the people who don't are going to misbehave one way or another. But no question that if we had talked about something like that a couple of years ago, it would have seemed crazy, the idea of banning alcohol aboard flights. But like so many things, no longer does seem crazy, does it?
Yeah, and Seth, I just have about 45 seconds here. So briefly, what else is the government doing, the FAA doing, to make sure that people are behaving themselves on airplanes?
Well, you know, one thing that changed early this year with the new administration is a lot of things that had been airline policies became federal mandates, including the masks, for example. So that gives the airlines that enforceability. And the FAA does fine people significantly in some cases. Airlines themselves can ban people from flying, but you can be talking mm-hmm. about tens of thousands of dollars in fines.
Wow.
Which is something that, yeah, most people obviously can't afford to pay. So a strong incentive to behave.
Seth Kaplan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Data from across the country shows wide disparities in the vaccination rates of different racial and ethnic groups. But the way that race and ethnicity is counted varies from one state to the next. And that, says experts, makes it harder to achieve vaccine equity. From member station KCUR in Kansas City, Alex Smith reports.
Ms. Robin Frazier!
How are you doing?
Community coordinator Yvette Richards welcomes congregants to a Sunday service at St. James United Methodist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. Before the pandemic, this African-American church was bustling on Sundays, but for more than a year, its pews remained empty as services were held online. The church lost many members due to the virus and is now hosting vaccination clinics. But Richard says members are still in shock.
People are really grieving, not only the loss of the loved one, but the loss of a whole year, a loss of being lonely, a loss of being at home, not being able to come to church, not being able to go out into the community.
Since the start of the vaccination effort, Missouri state leaders have insisted that getting vaccines into communities like this one is a top priority. And they've pointed to state data on race and ethnicity to show how closely equity is being monitored. But for Kansas City Health Department Director Dr. Rex Archer, one number is a giveaway that this data isn't right. The state website seems to show that multiracial Missourians have a vaccination rate of almost 65%, nearly double the state average. Dr. Archer thinks it's unlikely the rate is that good.
So there is some huge problem with the way the state is collecting race and ethnicity data under COVID vaccination.
Missouri state officials have acknowledged the inaccuracy since February, but they haven't managed to fix it. They've also found other data problems too. Health officials are now working to target vaccination campaigns in communities where rates are low. But Archer says the state's data provide little help.
I mean, we have to look at it, but it's got too many variables to be something we can count on.
It turns out that lots of states have data for COVID vaccinations that has health experts scratching their heads. In South Carolina, Asians, Native Americans, and Pacific Islanders are lumped into the same category. In Utah, residents can pick more than one race. And Wyoming doesn't report racial or ethnic data at all. Dr. Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo, an epidemiologist at the University of California, San Francisco, says that just as an uneven approach to containing the coronavirus led to a greater toll for Black and Latino communities, the inconsistent data collection is leaving the same groups out on vaccines.
At the very least, we need the same uniform standards that every state is using and every location that administers vaccine is using so that we can have some comparisons and design better strategies to reach the populations we're trying to reach.
In Missouri, the gaping vaccination disparities led state officials to change strategy in recent weeks and send more doses to urban centers like Kansas City, although state reports suggest that the disparities remain.
You are worthy of my praise.
Back at St. James United Methodist Church, Pastor Jackie McCall has been talking with many congregants who say they're still nervous about the shots, and she's been encouraging them to get vaccinated.
We want to be able to continue to be here, be in purpose, and do the things that God has called us to do. So let's go ahead and let's trust the process, let's trust God, and let's trust the science.
But trusting the vaccination data is something healthcare experts are having a difficult time doing. For NPR News, I'm Alex Smith in Kansas City.
This story first aired on Weekend Edition and was produced in partnership with KCUR and Kaiser Health News. Nike and MasterCard are the latest brands to stand behind tennis star Naomi Osaka's decision to withdraw from the French Open. The four-time Grand Slam champion said she had to step away for her own mental health after the French Open fined Osaka $15,000 for skipping a news conference following the first-round match on Sunday. Sports figures like Osaka have always been on the front lines of social, political, and cultural issues, and Osaka is the latest sports figure to specifically address mental health. And for more, let's bring in ESPN analyst and former U.S. Open singles finalist, Pam Shriver. Welcome to the show, Pam.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Thank you for being here. And Pam, before we get into this discussion, let's go over quickly exactly what happened. Osaka told French officials before Sunday's match that she wasn't up to doing media press briefings after the game. She says she suffers from anxiety and bouts of depression. Take us from there.
Yeah, well, she released the statement just a few days before the start of the French Open. It surprised the tennis world that a top player, who really it's counted on by the media as a connector to the fans to get the story out about the match. But her original statement started just a flurry of criticism from people in the media. But then on Saturday, I'll just say it was the four major tennis tournaments who came out with a statement that was partly empathetic, but also had a couple of paragraphs about that if Osaka kept her stance, she'd be given the code of conduct and could be defaulted from the tournament. And that's really when things escalated.
And Osaka called out the hypocrisy of organizations, as she calls them, for ignoring mental health while trying to make athletes like herself the centerpiece of their corporation. You've actually been down this road too before. Your thoughts on her stance?
Well, I think you have to look at some things that she started to talk about with her statement on the weekend where she withdrew, where she mentioned the impact and the trauma of the match against Serena in the finals of the U.S. Open, when the code of conduct came into play against Serena three different times, totally changing the way the match was played. And it basically took away Osaka's ability to have a joyful end to her first major win in singles. And she said that's when her depression started, which really, I think most people in profession in mental health care will say that is the type of event, that type of trauma. I was in that stadium, the booing and the noise and the anger. And Naomi felt it was towards her. And I think she is sensitive to noise. So I think going forward, things like this will be handled better in tennis. But this was just a disaster, the outcome.
Well, Serena Williams actually spoke about Naomi's decision after her first round win at the French Open. Let's listen.
The only thing I feel is that I feel for Naomi. I feel like I wish I could give her a hug because I know what it's like. Like I said, I've been in those positions. We have different personalities. Not everyone is the same.
Pam, to your point, what help is available within the workplace? Are there accommodations in place to help athletes? For instance, does the IFT, the International Tennis Federation, or the WTA, the Women's Tennis Association, actually have a policy in place? Could this have been avoided?
Well, the WTA started their healthcare service program decades and decades ago, and it is a wonderful program, and it includes a lot of support and can point you in the right direction if you need emotional and mental health help. I think as a tennis player trying to travel the world during a pandemic and living in this bubble, it puts an already very stressful job almost beyond what most people can handle. And I think that maybe the people who run Wimbledon, the US Open, the Australian Open, and the US Open who signed that letter over the weekend, I just felt like they really didn't have a full understanding of what someone like Naomi Osaka has been through in recent times.
Well, you know, this brings up another point for me. Historically, we've seen athletes meet the moment. It happened in the 60s at the height of the civil rights movement. More recently, Colin Kaepernick. But what Naomi is doing is putting herself first. She's sending a message that perhaps there's a generational shift between athletes willing to comply with these long-established norms set by sports authorities and younger players willing to engage in social activism and speak directly to fans on social media about what they're dealing with. Your thoughts on this and what this means moving forward for sports and maybe for tennis more specifically?
It's a huge game changer that athletes on their own social media platform can talk directly to their fans. Well, and Naomi Osaka with the U.S. Open last year, she was one of the leaders the week before the U.S. Open with social justice and peaceful protesting of police brutality. So she's proven that she's willing to take things on. And I think it's a good, I think it's really a good thing. It's just, you have to realize when you are a professional athlete and you have goals in mind, like winning majors, when you take on things like mental health, I think people have to be aware of what will be the repercussions once they announce something like what Naomi did last week.
That's ESPN analyst and former U.S. Open singles finalist Pam Shriver. Pam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.